This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. The website for the show is theconversationpod.com, which you can access not only from various parts of the universe, but also various parts of the World Wide Web, including countries outside of the United States. I'll get to that in a second. This is episode number 103 with Los Angeles Times art critic and Claremont Graduate University in Claremont, California, Professor David Pagel. We had a really good time with co-host Deb Cloudman once again joining the fold. We had a really good time. I think it's going to come across. And you know what? Say what you will about mainstream or newspaper art criticism versus your, I don't know, hipper, more inside catalog for sort of hot gallery type criticism. David was great to talk to, great guest, and ultimately was so great about the three of us is, you know, the dynamic that it was a conversation. You know, we left the realm of the interview and it became a conversation and a three-way conversation and a lot of improvisation. We covered a lot of different things, including everything you wanted to ever know about what it's like being a critic and being on that side of the dynamic. So great stuff to come on that. Do let us know what you think. And by the way, the most popular episode of the podcast is still, as far as I know, is with Christian Viveros Foné, the art critic of the Village Voice, for reasons that are complicated and a little hard to ascertain, but partially, I imagine, because he has a following from his writing for a number of years, and he was involved in something called Christian Gate, which you can find out if you listen to that episode. But all that to say that I'd like this episode to be a big one as well, not only because it's in the hometown of the podcast, but also, you know, because I think it's really fun and represents this three-way dynamic that I think can be so effective. And yeah, I just, you know, show your support for the form of podcasting in that way. The reason I mentioned the World Wide Web and all that is because I noticed in doing analytics recently that there are apparently a number of listens and downloads in surprising places, including Germany, Spain, Iran, and I think Russia, if I remember right. And I wanted to put that out there because if you are somebody listening in one of those places or elsewhere abroad from the United States, you know, give a shout out. We'd love to hear from you. I had a note from a local artist colleague telling me that he was in Vancouver recently and the conversation came up and he said, "Do I know the conversation?" And so you guys in Vancouver and elsewhere in Canada, you know, give a shout. Let us know that you are listening. I hate to bite the feeding hand, but you guys are a quiet bunch. And so I have to shake the tree a little bit to get you to pony up, even with letting me know that you're listening. That's kind of what I'm asking for right now. All right. I will talk to you more on the back end. I think without further ado, we should get to that conversation with David Pagel. It's an intense one, but it's a fun one, and it is coming up right now. I'll talk to you more on the back end. Thank you for being here.
He's ready.
This is the Conversation Western Edition, and I'm joined for what, the sixth time?
Maybe
who's counting?
Fifth, sixth, something like that.
But who's counting? Deb Cloudman. Hello.
Hey, it's nice to be here.
And we are joined by art critic of Los Angeles Times, David Pagel. Hello.
Hi.
And I was going to say Chris Knight couldn't make it.
Oh, thanks.
So we have David instead. But I thought that would be
rude.
You thought that would be kind of a
rude
punk move. Yeah. Yeah.
I did. Yeah. So I said, no, I'm not going to say
he's
that.
He's in my car.
He's been waiting out there for the last hour.
Well, go get him.
Really awkward.
So, well, David, I think we want to start, or I mm-hmm. want to start anyway, with the Los Angeles Times stamp of approval question.
Ask away.
And I realized as I've been thinking about this, that I should actually
be beating on the dealers that are so quick to grab every review, you know, and blast it to their, you know, their followers and put it into their press kit. So maybe we should drag some of them in. But
I don't have a problem with them doing that at all.
Exactly.
I agree.
But that said,
and to me, the when you get a bad review or a critical review, a lot of times then the dealers won't put that in their little booklet. Yeah. But I think that's a mistake. I think they should put it there.
Sure.
And they should say, like, look it, we're showing something that other people don't like, and we think it's good, even if Dave doesn't.
Right. So, I agree with you. I think, though, the place that we want to talk about first is the fact that there is one, other than Art Forum, which we could have is this whole separate conversation. The LA Times is the most, you know, consistently used and often used seal of approval for shows for press in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I never ever think of what I do as seal of approval behavior or stamp of approval.
You don't think of it that way, but that's how it gets appropriated. That's how
I'm not sure about that.
Okay. Do tell.
Yeah, well, I don't think any reader ever reads a movie review as the last word. And I think people look at movie reviews like, oh, so-and-so wrote it. So-and-so usually hates the stuff I like and likes the stuff I hate. So if he hates something, I probably like it. And they go and respond to it that way. And I think actually art reviews are similar. The people think like, oh, it's Pagel going off on this again. It probably actually means this. So I never think it's as simple as critics said this, case closed. I always think of it as what any piece of criticism does is make a subjective argument and try to convince people that that argument holds water. And then those people can argue more among their peers than their selves. So I think it's all part of a discussion, argument, discourse, blah, blah, blah.
I agree. That's all fair and true. Mm-hmm. However, the underlying point remains that is the one place of where the dialogue starts. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. People are not going to Notes on Looking or Deb, name a blog that's based in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Name one.
Do you really have to do this to me right now?
Well, we can edit this out. That's the good part.
I would have said Notes on Looking first. Is I Call It Oranges is here.
That's right. That's it, Chad. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I can think of a lot of smaller ones that, like Figure Ground or Painting in LA, which is less. LA I'm Yours does a lot of focus on artists, but not exclusively art related.
What was that one painting?
Painting in LA.
Do they do reviews?
No, mostly interviews. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. Mm-hmm. So it's.
So in any case, nobody's going to I Call It Oranges or Notes on Looking and saying, "Oh my God, did you see that review?" And
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it depends. I mean, I was always crazy excited when I would have a show that was in Notes on Looking because. Mm-hmm. I have so much respect for, you know, where Jeff Tuck was coming from and the way that he would approach it. And I, as a gallerist and just somebody who was kind of hungry for the arts in Los Angeles, would look at some of those blogs as even more of a guide than the LA Times in terms of what I would want to know about and wasn't as easy for me to find, you know. So I think there's a, but I do think that if you're talking about, if people are going to select a couple of articles for a press packet, they're going to do the ones that they know that collectors will look at and say, "Ooh, this is a you know, for
this matters.
Lack of, and for lack of a better term, this is a brand that I know and can trust." You know, that's the thing that happens. You know, but they're always
in my experience as a writer, I've almost never had a collector act because of a review.
Right.
Almost never. To me, what a review in the paper will get is more people in to see the show.
That's definitely
and a lot
true.
More, but yeah. to get the pocketbook out is a whole nother
yeah.
That's a fair step. Point. By the way, I want to backtrack just a second because I neglected to make sure or ask whether you have reviewed one of Deb's shows in the past.
No, I'm embarrassed to say.
So you got a clean slate here. Okay.
Yeah.
That was my sense.
She's pissed.
I have a knife hidden in this boot right here, actually. I'm just waiting for my moment. Yeah. No, not at all.
So you want me to pick it up or you want
to,
you have something?
Yeah,
so it seems, it seems to me you think there's it's a problem that too many people read the LA Times, or it's a problem there aren't more outlets?
That's a great question. Yeah. I think you know, I guess I haven't thought it through maybe as thoroughly as I could, but I think my
time.
Sense we have time here. Maybe this is what this is all about.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think it's the problem is that the galleries appropriate the reviews more than not of which are positive. I'm gonna guess that it's like 75% are gonna be positive, if not higher.
Personally, my percentage is probably way higher than that. In the old days, I would go after more things and try to obliterate them from the face of the planet because I thought they didn't merit anyone's attention.
Right.
But as I got older, I got it became less satisfying for me to spend an afternoon or a day with shit I hated, trying to make other people hate it or try to get rid of it. And I just like, you know, I'm in it for me. I'm in it for my pleasure. And I would rather find something that I thought wasn't getting enough attention and try to get more people to pay attention to that. And I, you know, I would, if I fell in love with something, I'm going to broadcast my love as much as I can. And I think there's, and to me in the one thing I like about the newspaper is that it's not just an art audience. It's potentially a bigger audience. Your art form is, those are specialists and there's nothing wrong with specialists. I have a lot of respect for dentists and I want my dentist to be reading Dental Weekly. Same with, artists, dealers, collectors, you should be reading Art Form, but the newspaper has a bigger, broader audience, at least potentially. And I think there's, in our general culture, there's so much disdain for the visual arts and contempt for artists. And the kind of general attitude is like, artists are charlatans who are trying to rip me off. And so I am aware of that audience and trying to find art that I think is really serious and merits attention and to get people to pay attention to it. So I'll look for things. If there's well-known people out there making work that's talked about, if I can talk about it in a different way, I'll try to do that to try to change the way people look at it. But it is, I should do more kind of, you know, pit bull reviews or attack reviews or going after stuff, because those are the ones that people actually talk to me most about.
Right.
Interesting.
I get way more feedback when I go after somebody than when I love something. And that, you know, they are really fun.
Yeah, I bet.
To go after.
I have a question about the should in that sentence, because I think that's something that interests me a lot. Is, you know, the way you said it just now, the should seemed like it was related to this is something that would create even more dialogue in a different way. But I also often wonder about what the shoulds feel like when you're a critic and where those come from. If those are internally motivated or if there is a culture of, you know, you are supposed to have a certain kind of balance in the kind of works you review or in the kind of spaces or,
That's a really good question. It is, I mean, to me, criticism doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's not just me in my garage talking to myself. Right. I feel like I'm talking to people. So I want to talk to as many different kinds of people and as many different backgrounds, blah, 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 and all that. So it's constant negotiation with, you don't want to cover the same gallery every time. You don't want to cover the same material every time. You want to really spread it out. But then you don't want to say, here's another monochrome painter that I think is great. You say, well, I've covered too many monochrome painters. Like, that's not fair either. So it's always a
always a balance and a juggle, and there's never enough space or a time or enough time to do everything I want to do. So I'm always
And let me get back to what he said before we get too far away from it, which is that you came to the decision that, you know, spending an afternoon with the, you know, trying to exoriate somebody for the show, it makes a lot of sense to me in that by spending time with them and putting it out there, you're just drawing attention to them. And if you rather they go away, you just ignore it as if it didn't exist.
Well, sometimes it's so bad you have to
give us some recent examples.
Kick it. Oscar Mario. I think it's just,
was it the mistake room?
Yeah. I mean, he's,
or what is it called here now?
It's the mistake.
It's still the mistake room.
Yeah. And to me, it's like, you know, there's so much institutional monetary support behind that it's, I think it needs a kick.
Yeah.
Where, you know, if those very same things were made by some kid, just, you know, with his MFA from Otis, you just ignore it. It's like, oh, this is a kid who hasn't found his stuff yet. But it's like, they're $1 million things.
And I'm gonna guess that unlike some of your other hatchet jobs, that not a lot of people came up and talked to you about that piece.
No, tons. What
did they say?
Thank you for doing that. I've always thought that. And to me, that's one of the best things. Like, you know, if I, you know, artist A has a show, I love the work, I rave about it, then artist A will write me a letter and say, like, thank you so much for the review. It's like, well, of course. Yeah. Like, it's a love fest. But it's interesting for me. It's more, I mean, that's nice. It's really, I mean, I have written what I think are really positive reviews and get a fuck you letter in the mail for not truly understanding the work. And those are like, oh, wow.
Do you want to give us an example of one of those?
No,
cases?
I'll protect the lunatics from themselves. one was like, it was like 5 years after a positive review. I turned on my computer Sunday morning and was like, fuck you. It's like, and I was like, whoa, that's been simmering for a long time.
Wow.
But what I would get back to the point I started to make, I like when I, you know, I'll write about someone's work and then someone else will write in and say, I was really interested to read what you read about that because I had never seen the work that way before and blah, blah, blah. And this is why it's interesting to me. And to me, that's more satisfying because there's no vested interest in it. You know, it's not just a big wet kiss. Thank you. It's like, oh, something happened. And I get those a lot for the negative reviews where I'll get artists like, you know, they'll come and say, I've always hated that crap. That person's been getting way too much attention. Thank you for trying to step on that bug.
Ed Shad, who we mentioned his blog, actually told me about a dealer who, at least on one, if not more occasions, harangued him for a bad, you know, or critical review that he had written. I'm not going to mention what dealer was. Can you talk about any of those experiences?
Dealers usually don't grouse about bad reviews. A handful of artists do, but I don't have that much contact with a dealer chastising me for anything I've said.
Also don't want to alienate
because
I
mean, all of a sudden, like, they, that okay, that show's over, they have the next one. But I've had some. I had, you know, one time a long time ago, Sean Regan went, it was the first now I can't remember what show it was. I think it was a Damien Hirst show. And I was, when she had a space with Stuart on Elmont, and I you know, trashed it. I thought it was terrible. And I went into the next show, and she's like, tisk, tisk, tisk. And that was, to me, perfect. It's like, she was like, it was humorous. She was, you know, she has a job to do. I have a job to do. She respected that fact, and she's going to record, like, you know, it was a really funny, like, bad critic, but it was nice because it wasn't, you know, get the fuck out of my gallery, you creep. Right. Or like, I mean, I've had people turn on their heels and walk away. And it's like, you know, I'm doing my job. You're doing your job. You can be friendly and disagree. So that was a nice touch, but otherwise, now dealers, usually don't complain. I actually can't.
No set of art world individuals comes up to you in person and yells at you for a review.
Oh, no, artists do.
What's that like? Can you give us a story?
Oh, it's delicious.
Yeah. It sounds like it.
It depends how they do it. I admire the ones who treat it like that just happens. That's part right. of the endeavor. Like I make stuff. I put it on the world. People are going to talk about it. They're not going to talk about it how I like that just happens. So those artists who get bad reviews and talk to me about other things, I respect a lot. Ones that get so worked up that they can't even speak because they got a bad review once, I think that they're immature.
Yeah.
I think at this point in time with the market and the media that we have, for any artist to get a review and of course the Los Angeles Times, our paper of record, that they should be grateful because they're on the radar.
Yeah.
And that's really, in a lot of cases, all you can ask for.
Well, but that's I think, so much what's difficult about, I'm sure, every community and definitely the art world is that once you reach a certain point, you're always looking at the next point. Yeah. So you stop the gratitude for, hey, I'm getting reviews and people are talking about my work, and you get on to the, when's my next museum show and where's my rave review and this other, I think it's hard to maintain.
There's something that has been credited to Leo Castelli. I don't know if he actually said it, but someone once asked, like, Leo, how do you measure reviews?
Yeah.
And he said, with a ruler. And so his point was, it doesn't matter what it says, it matters how long it is. And for him, attention, having discussion around the work is what counts. It's not mindless praise or mindless criticism. The quality, or the quantity of the discussion is what matters.
Yeah.
But I wanted to go back to say about, I've been on the receiving end of reviews because I've also, I'm also a curator. And when I organize a show and it gets coverage, I'm actually looking for a thoughtful response, and there is that excitement of like, oh wow, my show got covered. I run out, buy the paper, look for it, and then it's kind of like just fluff.
What paper are we talking about?
When I would organize shows, I would travel around the country, so it'd be in Las Vegas or in Houston or in New York or in Madison. Newspaper. Sometimes in Australia. And it would be, there's that moment of excitement of like, it counts, it's in print.
Right.
But for me, it would wear thin really, really quickly and be like, oh, that's just, they didn't say anything. And it's like, well, got coverage, but it wasn't. But the ones that stuck with me are the thoughtful ones. And it wouldn't necessarily be, I wasn't looking for a pat on the back and love and accolades. What I call it, the admiration of idiots is only so satisfying. Actually, after a while, you want to actually have an intelligent discussion with something. And when that happens, it's really, really meaningful. And I think there's a big difference between finding meaning in art and the monetary cost of a work of art. And I think as a critic, I deal with the former a lot more than the latter.
Right. And Deb, I just want to sort of put a final point on, or a finer point on what you were saying about how artists, always want to have ambitions to, have
next
thing. I think even along that spectrum, just getting a review should be enough.
No.
I don't think they should ever care if it's a great review.
Yeah.
Because that's just wanky.
Yeah. Nice use of wanky. I agree. I also like that. Potentially from Leo Castelli quote about the length. And part of the reason I would say that I like that is so often longer reviews are the ones that actually aren't just heaping on praise and are in fact questioning things.
Yeah.
And, I definitely have artists who will get reviews like that and be upset, super excited to have the review, but be upset that their work is being questioned. I think it's so much more of a testament to the strength of work that it inspires a longer conversation, including questions.
Challenges.
Definitely.
So,
definitely.
Well, while we're still on reviews and, uh-huh. and relationships to people who are in those reviews. I happen to remember a review of Carl Handel, who is a uh-huh. Multiple-time guest slash co-host on this show, uh-huh. A show you kind of excoriated of his work at Mocha.
That was a good one.
And so I'm just curious if he said anything to you or anybody else did about that.
Other people, other artists came up and said, I'm really happy to read that. I hate that shit, too. More than once.
You heard it here first, Carl.
Yeah, no, Carl knows that.
And Carl's got a show opening this weekend, by the way.
Don't I know it. I ran into him at Suzanne Vielmetter years after it happened. And I was looking around the show, and he was. And Suzanne was being a proper human being and hostess. And so Carl, you know David? And Carl's like, yes. but he didn't grouse. He was just like, yes. He did send me the New York Times much more positive assessments of his show, which I'm well aware of. I think the work is sufficiently celebrated,
right?
And me further celebrating it would be a waste of ink. And I wasn't into it, and I said my piece.
Yeah,
not slowing down sales whatsoever.
Here's a question: mm-hmm. since we're talking about as a curator receiving mm-hmm. reviews and being on that end. Mm-hmm. When you're choosing to write a review, what prompts you to write one that is shorter, you know, and maybe less involved versus one that is?
The easiest ones to write about are the ones that I have a strong reaction to.
Right.
If highly positive, highly negative, those are really, really easy to dive into.
Right.
It's like kind of those middle ones where it's like,
yeah,
the work is fine.
Right.
And it's like, those aren't that much.
They're not
exciting.
Right. And you have to work at them.
So they'll be shorter. But in the paper, it's pretty, you get one longy and three shorties. And it's supposed to be like one is 450 words and then the other three are 250 words.
And do you generally?
But I cheat. And, we'll shave some words here and put some words there.
Do you generally get to choose which shows you review?
Almost exclusively.
Okay. So it's very rare that somebody would say.
I'll get the list and says four reviews needed, none assigned.
Okay.
Four reviews needed, none assigned. And every once in a while, four reviews needed, one assigned.
Interesting.
Are they assigned pre-viewing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
No, I get my little, my assignment sheet and the, now it's email. It used to be.
Right.
Facts.
So you're not then getting the sort of more organic arc of going and seeing a bunch of shows and going, I'm going to write about this one, and this one.
Well, oh, yeah. No, that's what I do.
Yeah.
Because most of it says, four reviews needed, zero assigned. So
you know how many you're going to do. But
yeah, and it's totally up to me. The way that newspaper does it is whichever critic is on that week has first shot at all the shows that opened that week and any other shows that are left over from previous weeks. So we can't reserve stuff where you get like the advanced schedule for Gagosian and Blum and Poe. And they're like, well, I'm going to cherry pick, for the next 12 months now. It's like, you're on that week. You get first crack at what opens that week. And usually the assignments are, often it'll be if a gallery moves locations or if it's maybe a gallery that hasn't been covered or an artist hasn't been covered. But I really don't, I can't tell what the assignments are. But it's almost, it's like 90% we get to choose.
So is it a cycle then that you'll have a week and then one of the other critics will have a week
and so on? Yeah, so it'll go, Leah, Christopher, me, Sharon. And then Leah is just...
Got it. Yeah. Okay. I think we're clear.
Yeah. I was on the receiving end of a review that I think was assigned.
And how
it was interesting. Because she came in, this is when we were in our original space, and she came in and said, I think she said that she had been sent to review the show. And I was
kind of maybe against your will, you know? But it was, but it was interesting, but it definitely brought
up. Was it Leah Ullman?
Yeah. But it definitely brought up the question for me of, you know, how often that happens versus how, and it made sense. It was an artist who was a much older artist who, you know, had been known, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. And it kind of made sense as a historical kind of thing that it would be.
That an editor might have
said, exactly. Yeah. So, but yeah, it seemed like an interesting
But actually, dynamic. Sometimes those turn out great.
Yeah. Because
it's like, oh.
No, it was an interesting review. It was a very thoughtful.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah. You think like, you know, part of the fun is just like being thrown out there and say, okay, what am I going to say about this?
Yeah.
Well, what kind of, before we get into how you would characterize your own aesthetic or sensibility.
Oh, just what? Brilliant.
Aside from that.
Perfect, obviously.
What? Need we say more?
I think you have caught us off guard with your charm. I was going to ask you, in any of those conversations that you have with the people that, you know, more safely approach you via letter versus those in person, can you sort of condense or, you know, have an amalgamation of what they have said and attribute some kind of description to your sensibility through that?
Dear asshole, I'm a genius, you're a moron, fuck off. It's like, that is...
You're the dear asshole guy?
Yeah, it's...
Why is that?
Because they got a bad review.
I was thinking more something along the lines
content-wise?
Yeah, Dear David, I was intrigued to read your most recent review. It strikes me that you are a lover of painters. You know, I was thinking a little bit less. Never get anything that thoughtful.
No, but I do get accused of liking painting more than is humanly understandable. Yeah.
Dear David.
Yeah.
Painting is dead. Wake up.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like,
And that was something I was going to ask as a follow-up question when you were talking earlier about thinking less of what you do as a stamp of approval and more as the way you described it almost, the way that somebody would expect, you know, reading an opinion piece from David Brooks and they know how he thinks and where he's at and, you know, they're going
to I think that's really, really smart to bring up the opinions page in the newspaper because that's what I do.
Right.
It's the opinion page. It's not front page news. And a lot of people say, well, you know, you're a critic. You're supposed to be objective and historical. I'm like, no, I'm a critic. I'm supposed to be subjective and partisan.
Yeah.
And also persuasive and articulate and insightful and blah, blah, blah. But it's not front page news.
Right.
It's opinion page stuff. And it's all completely 100% subjective. This is... And what bugs me are critics who act like they're not.
Right.
They're like pretending to be, like, I'm the voice of history, or like, I'm educating you. And I'm like, no, you're not. You're going out there, having an experience, reporting back on that experience, and convincing me, the reader, that experience is worth reading about and maybe even worth driving across town, paying for parking and checking it out. But it's completely
opinion. Opinion with maybe some historical context or
a little bit of historical. I think, there's so much there. To me, the pendulum has swung too far towards historical context. I think it's swinging back a little bit, but to me, it's like, come on, it's the newspaper. This is not our historical research paper.
Where in what venues do you think that pendulum has swung too far
towards context? Art schools all across the country.
I thought we were talking about reviews though,
but
and how reviews are read. And I think art mags are probably too much context, but definitely the way it's taught. So there are, see, as a critic, I don't think it's my job to put art into its context. I think it's my job to take viewers and put them in the context of the art. Mm-hmm. So, as a reviewer, it's like I have so little space
right.
that I'm going to spend almost all the time with the art in the show.
Right.
And so it won't be about the artist's reputation.
Yeah.
It won't be about the artist's sales. It won't be about the cool gallery it's in. It won't be the hip, funky place downtown it's in. It's like, it really is going to be about the art. Yeah. And I think, and that's where I think the pendulum has swung so much in our culture towards celebrity, towards price, towards history, towards reputation, you know, also to like, to, you know, to identity markers, like who is this helping, blah, blah, blah. That I, in that way, kind of, I'm an old fashioned, like, let's look at the art for a little while. And actually, I think that shows greater respect for the artist who made it, mm-hmm. and also for the viewer who's going to go see it. Cause my, I think the readers go in and like, they want to hear me talking about what's on the floor, on the wall, hanging from the ceilings, projected on the wall. Right. That's like, that's, it's pretty basic. Yeah. So that's where like the context and history and the education side.
You do write for catalogs from time to time.
Oh yeah. Quite a bit.
So, and you get a lot more word count, I would imagine. Right.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So do you have to get into context and whatnot when you do that? Or do you try to stay on the art the whole time?
Funny. One thing I love about the newspaper is that I don't have to answer to anyone, that it can be me. Mm-hmm. Whereas as soon as I'm doing a catalog, you know, if like say you're the artist and you're the dealer,
right.
You guys hired me.
Right.
And sometimes it's seamless and smooth. Like, yes, we love it. You know, some suggestions. Other times it's like, well, I really wanted this. And the dealer will come back and say, well, I really wanted this. And like, you know, and I'm like, well, you should just write it yourself. So, but no, there's a more complicated triangular setup. Yeah. And I mean, literally, I have hired myself out to the artist and the gallery or the university gallery and the curator. And it's like I have more, there's more cooks in the kitchen. You know, I have bosses to answer for.
Too many cooks in the kitchen, famous video.
Yeah. where the, you know, with the newspaper, there's it's solo cooking. You can.
That makes, go. Yeah. I agree with that approach. Yeah. We neglected to mention, and I neglected to mention, I'm not going to put any blame on Deb, that you teach concurrently with your art criticism. You teach at Claremont. You do, the studio visit rounds with grad students, and you also teach artists how to write statements. And what was the other one?
And a survey course.
Survey from how long ago?
Is it 1957 to 1974?
Oh. What do you call that period?
Sounds like fun.
57 to 74?
That's the high point.
pinnacle of modern art.
Well, no, so it started, you know, originally in the early 90s when I started teaching it, it was post-war American art. So it was supposed to go, you know, 1945 to the present. And that was really hard to go from 45 to 90. And then it was even harder to go from 45 to 2000. Right. And now it's really, really hard. And so I just shrunk it down to what I could manage in a semester, which is 15 weeks. And it's some of my favorite stuff.
You realize I have to jump in here. You realize at a certain point that you were spending 10 and a half weeks on minimalism and explaining it, that you had to
and then race through everything else. Yeah.
So the reason partially for my bringing up the Claremont is I think Deb and I would both be curious to know about any potential conflicts of interest and how you navigate that whole scenario. Because a lot of Claremont students go out into the world and are showing galleries, right?
Yeah, yeah. I would be curious to know how you pictured a conflict. Like what?
Deb, take it away.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like
nice. Thanks, buddy.
I can take it if you want.
No, yeah. I think it's an interesting kind of question in general in terms of. So from different critics that Michael has talked to, there are different perceptions of what a conflict of interest might be.
Yeah, that's what I want to know.
That's the.
So it's a conflict to teach someone.
If you taught somebody and then
write about them.
Right.
That's clear.
That's the main one. Yeah.
Okay. So it's like, and so what I'll do is right after they graduate,
right?
I won't write about them for quite a while.
Right.
But I won't, you know, never write about them because to me it would be worse to punish them because of the accident that they
don't
they went
take
to school
David's class. Yeah, he'll never ever write about you.
So, but it, so it, to me, and that's just like it looks bad if you you know the kid graduates in May, gets a show in June, and the review comes out in July. So, but that's a perfectly self-imposed. I just like I steer clear, but it's not forever.
Right.
But that to me, that's like it's. So, like, so they get an education. So, they, to me, that sells artists so short in thinking that they're going to go to graduate school and I'm going to tell them what to do and they're going to listen to what I say and then they're going to do it and they're going to get a show and then I'm going to give them a good grade in the paper. And that is such a stupid understanding of what an artist is. Like, the only good ones I've ever had have never listened to anything I've said. They're in school, they're doing their thing, bouncing their ideas off me, fighting, arguing, and going somewhere else. So it's not like they're these robots that get...
Well, actually, you know, what you're making me realize is that school is clearly a much better context to ask the question about sensibility. Because I imagine a lot, you know, numerous students over the years have... in so many words said to you, you know what, David, you're too much this or you're too much that, or this is where I'm coming from.
I flunk those little bags. I think that may get at a difference between what I do in a studio visit and what I do in the newspaper, because they're really, really different things. And some students will come and say, okay, review me. And I was like, you haven't had a show. You know, like this is, and maybe back to the food thing. Like when you're, you know, the gallery exhibition is like a fully cooked and presented meal in a restaurant, and the artist's studio in grad school is like the farm where the products are growing. They haven't even chopped it up yet or washed it off. And so it's, and like one is made for public display and one isn't. Their art studios are still very private, or if I mean, not absolutely private, but they sure aren't public spaces. And to me, once you're an artist and you decide to have an exhibition and you have a place to have an exhibition, you put it out there for the public, it's fair game. We can come out with whatever we want and go after it. Whereas like the students starting out in school, it's a game preserve. It's a protected area. It's much more about exploring ideas. And the way I'm interested in teaching is trying to find out what the artist is trying to do and then help them try to realize that more clearly and make it stronger. But it's never like, hi, I'm Dave. I like painting. I like yellow. You should make yellow paintings. It's like, it's just like nuts.
Meanwhile, there are actually some artist professors at some schools who we won't mention, but we can sort of imply very strongly who are almost like that.
Yeah, and to me, they're like 3 centuries late. It's just like that. It's, I actually think that's like gross negligence in terms of.
And they might not even be painting professors, by the way.
They might not be.
They might not even be painting professors.
Oh yeah, no, they're probably no. I think they're guilty in all media.
Okay,
but but it's the conceptual Nazis you're referring to.
I don't know. Am I?
No, I was guessing.
Well, actually, no, you know,
yeah, I just think that it's like teaching is a really delicate thing, and it's not making clones. And that's appalling.
Right. Yeah. Right. I get your point. I was just trying to, you know, find a way into a little perspective on, you know, what your sensibility is. And we're having a hard time sort of pinning that down.
Yeah.
I imagine, though, that there have been a few cases of students who are like ready to show, like at least by their final year, they're like, boom, they get placed somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So is it, I don't know if it's any different with those kids.
Still like this studio is, they're not getting a review from me. It's still like, how do we push this further? What are you really interested in? What do you really care about? What, you know, why this, why that? The most, developed or most sophisticated or most advanced are the easiest to teach because you just have conversations with them.
Right.
It doesn't even feel like work. And you're like, you know, going and like literature comes up. You say, oh, have you read this? And you're like, no, I've read that. And it's like, and you just, you know, you're kicking
dialogue
ideas around.
You're reminding
like, the other ones like, you know, have you heard of Rauschenberg? No. It's like, well, now we have some learning to do. And then you're like, yeah.
Rauschenberg.
Yeah. I'm kidding.
You're reminding me, though, that you are part of a tradition, for lack of a better word, maybe that's too strong a word, of critics who do go into the studios. It's not like the sort of the old model. Although, you know, I wonder if Chris Knight and, you know, and other critics who are sort of more divorced from that kind of environment. But there are a lot of, all that to say that there are a lot of critics who do go into the studios and they do, you know, they trash people's work and then they're in the studio and they're really nurturing. And so you have that kind of, I mean, Jerry Saltz and Roberta do that.
Yeah, I think.
You know?
Yeah. I just think they're really, I think right now we're in this kind of moment of great cultural mushiness where everything is kind of blahing together like it's just been jammed in a gigantic Cuisinart and put on high forever. And everything's just kind of this soup. And I think I like, I still like different behaviors and different situations with different materials and different people. And so that's one thing I like about criticism and, you know, in contradistinction to journalism or in distinction to promotionalism and it's and as something other than art. And to me, there's a work of art sitting there, and then you may put a piece of criticism next to it. They don't overlap. They're these poles that set up something. There's different things happening. And I think that, you know, a critic can, you know, when I have my teaching hat on, I'm doing one thing. When I have my critic hat on, I'm something else. When I have a curator hat, something else. And I think that it's to me, it's really important that we don't lose sight of difference, and I think that the actually the more difference, the better. And it is like this kind of, I mean, this idea that you go to a diner and you get a curated sandwich is just like, it's like, please, you just made the sandwich, and like, and I don't need my bartender to be a mixologist. It's like, just pour me the goddamn martini. I don't, you know, it's.
I want to know when hand-picked, which I think used to be the term, turned into curated.
Yeah.
Like there have been all these different...
In May.
Yeah, there was a moment. Yeah.
And whenever they have that hand-picked music, I was like, hand-picked noses. Like, keep it to yourself. It's like, hand-picked strawberries. We eat them, but they don't get credit for the hand-picking them. It was this moment where all of a sudden, it was like everything was curated. And it's like,
it was amazing.
It was.
What are you thinking of when you talk about that?
Curated.
The hand-picked music is from NPR.
It was from KCRW. Every time I hear Jason Bentley say that, I die a little bit inside. But that's just a personal thing. But that was sort of the thing. And then the curated thing happened. It was.
It just all of a sudden everything was curated.
Like shops. Like stores, websites, specialty stores.
Yeah. Oh, curated was appropriated by everyone.
Yes. Everyone, yeah. It's like
curated selection of wines.
Why can't it just be a wine selection?
Like, right.
It just can't.
But, yeah. No, I literally got a sandwich.
Well, you know what? Actually, that reminds me, we're going to have to talk about practice. Because if we're going to talk about words, because this has been on my mind a lot lately.
Have you heard practice one too many times?
Well, you know, it's funny. I actually heard it. To be honest with everyone, I heard it at the very beginning of this podcast. It seems like I must have heard, not this podcast,
but
the first show of this podcast in 2011. Yeah. I felt like, oh my God, that's so pretentious. And come I haven't heard it the last 15 years? And then now it's like when I hear it talked about yoga and, you know, and meditation, it's like it's art practices spoiled all the other practices.
Yeah. Well, I have a friend who's like, God damn it, you're an artist making art in your studio. Attorneys have practices. Doctors have practices. You're neither of those things. Quit pretending you are. And so there is that like, I want to be professional. It's a practice. It came from that. I also think it comes out of academic Marxism, where there's theory and practice.
Yeah.
And then the really sexy is praxis, where it's P-R-A-X-I-S. Like, ooh, it's a little Frankfurt school in there. and then it just became like this thing. And then I have another friend's like, oh, shut up already. If you're just practicing, I don't want to look at it. I want to see the actual, get out there and play the game.
Right.
It's like, there's like, like baseball players practice and then they go to the game and play it.
Okay. But here's my question. It also functions in a way that condenses the statement of talking about what somebody's doing in a studio. I will admit that I use it often because it's one of those things that you can use when you're talking
just
to people
don't
and
use
say,
it in mixed company.
This is a, I'm probably going to turn red every time I use it and no longer be functional as an artist. And it's going to be both of your
you
fault.
It,
if I can get people to say no worries and practice a little bit less.
Both of those
when did
things.
No worries get? That's Australian. The first time I heard it was in Australia and no worries. And now it's everywhere.
It's a thing. It's here's my question for both of you.
Okay.
So it also, along with the fact that it is, you know, clearly trendy and has this sort of sexy element to it that people are into right now, it also has a function.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it replacing?
It's true. Mm-hmm. I have been listening to, as opposed to reading, Sarah Thornton's two books, mm-hmm. 7 Days in the Art World and 33 Artists in 3 Acts. And there are a few different episodes where the word practice comes up, and it's mentioned for the various, you know, it's described very gently. Why are you using practice here? This is why I'm using practice here, you know. And then at one point, it's kind of made reference to. And you read those?
I did. Yeah.
So you know what I'm talking about.
I do. But I also think that it's something that when you talk about. It can have, you can completely overuse it, but it can have specific uses because if I'm talking about, let's say I'm saying Michael's work in the studio does this, which totally makes sense and I don't need to use something there. What if I'm talking about somebody who has a way of working that is, you know, over here installation and over here, you know, a public project and photograph and over here, then it becomes very it makes my job easier to say
his practice.
Right.
His practice encompasses and focuses.
I think in the old days, when I was young in the 19th century, we would call it her oeuvre.
Because that's not pretentious.
No, but no one says that anymore. But that's the French. Artist's body of work. You'd have a painting, and then it would belong to this body of work, and then all the bodies of work
come
would add up to the oeuvre.
Right.
But can you
but
say
now
that
we can't say oeuvre, so we say practice. It's like that's what practice is the new oeuvre.
It is, except that. Yeah.
And it's and oeuvre has too much to do with objects and sales and the taint of commerce. And practice is just artists doing stuff.
Well, oeuvre also implies longevity, right? It implies that you have maybe at least a decade or a couple decades worth.
And you can have a practice. You can
have
practice in a week,
right? Well, no, I mean it's a. Yeah. And but I also have heard plenty of people. Yeah,
practice is oeuvre light.
I like it. I've also heard plenty of people complain about. The term work, too.
Really?
That this is
see, that's the word that I like, and I would go
to me,
with.
That's the neutral, like, when this is so, well, I really don't like to think of it as work. It's really more like play. It's like, good.
There
you
was
just keep playing.
keep wanking.
There was a statement.
No, I won't take anyone's play away from them. You want to play? Go ahead.
And it was a few years ago that came out from the public school, which is a resource in Los Angeles that does some really great, I'm going to say really great work because I think it's allowed in that sentence, but they came out with something that was something of a manifesto, and part of it was, you know, we are artists, we do not make work, what we do is not work, and that was interesting to me too. I feel like any term, you know, words are fun to play with.
They're all fodder.
What about
for praise and scorn?
What about criticality?
Oh. See, I studied semiotics, so I can put an ality on the end of anything and just have fun with it. But yeah,
I think that works in print, but in speaking, yeah, exactly. David's making a gagging motion
as well. He should. Well, it adds an extra level of
bullshit.
Remove. Well, yeah.
I mean, it's like I actually have people refer to it as like, oh, this work has it. Like in the old days, like you know, it has soul, and like you can't say that now, but it has. Criticality. It's like, what the fuck does criticality look like?
It
means like I'm standing back here saying other stuff sucks. Is that the so it's like the work is like this? Like, it's like, is it like modernist self reflexivity? It's like, but it's just gotten like it's become formula for like, I've dotted all my I's and crossed all my T's and I'm making post-conceptual academic stamp of approval work.
Everything is contained within this. Yeah. It doesn't need to talk to anything else. Said, it just talks to itself.
Level of
how often are you in seminar situations?
Like weekly.
Okay. Yeah. So to what extent do you reign over your kingdom by... you know,
iron fist.
Discouraging your students from overusing cliches.
Oh, no more than I just have here.
Good.
Keep a little gag.
Yeah. No, my class is, it's my class. You come in here at noon, you stay till 3.
And if you use the word criticality, if you use it well, I'm not going to come down on you.
No, the more I can get people to talk, they can say anything. But I'll go.
They're
off.
A reticent bunch.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting. Hmm. That's Oh, so they're millennials, so they're all on their phones.
Really interesting. No, there's no phones in my class. It's a really interesting mix of nationalities and levels of experience and ages and pretty. Quiet and respectful.
That's nice.
So it's more effort getting people to talk. But I'm not shy about my opinions.
Right.
But I'm not a terrorist in my class.
No.
If they want to blather on about criticality, they can do so under their breath.
That's great.
But it's much more about in making more things possible than making things not possible. I think that there's so much teaching is like saying you can't do this, you can't do this, you have to think about the consequences. And I'm like, just do something. Find something you care about and go with it. Mm. So I'm much more of a encourager, cajoler, enabler, cheerleader. Hopefully, my goal would be to inspire someone to do something. It's never about you shouldn't do that. It's like a sorry, that's bad gender politics reflected in that. It's like, just do something. I'm like,
do you think some of your colleagues are discouraging in some cases, or is that a question unfair
I don't
question
know. I don't team teach, and we keep it I don't police other people. They can do what they
you're not
what they want. Every once in a while you get a student's like, well, so and so said this about my work. It's like, I don't care. Right now it's you and me. We're going to talk about your work because I don't want secondhand stuff at all. You got 30 minutes, firsthand material. Let's go. Well, I'm confused. What is it? Go ask him. And because that's one of the great things about the Claremont, where it's one on one, where you don't get this kind of potentially sick, messed up, two faculty battling over soul of student, and then student cozying up to one, other one getting mad, striking out at another one, and you get this really twisted family behavior, which I've seen at other art schools. It's like, holy shit, my family was normal compared to that. And so it's just one to one to really to keep it simple. And and when I meet with you, we talk about your stuff, and then when you meet with him, you talk about his stuff. And it might be completely opposed, and a lot of the students are like, what the fuck? It's like, Pagel said this, he said this, what? And we're like, figure it out.
This might be an overly basic question, but what do you think has changed most, both in teaching and in criticism, since you started doing it? Doing both.
It's much more surveilled and much more professional.
And we're talking about criticism.
Teaching.
Teaching.
Yeah. Okay. No, criticism, people care. I think people are less interested in criticism now than when I started. When I started, it seemed to be, someone was talking about Dave Hickey's Invisible Dragon, and said, "Oh, that's the last book that everyone read," and I thought that really captured. Like, there was a time where everyone interested in art would do the same sorts of things, and that's from when I started to now. That's changed. Where the points of reference are more dispersed, and there's more of them, and they're not together. where in the old days, like, you know, everyone would have seen that.
Right.
Everyone would have gone to Schnabel's show.
Right.
And everyone would have seen the Peter Halley show. There was like, it was,
right.
There were certain things that everyone did, and those things now don't hold true. Like, and you had to have an opinion on, the Ashley Bickerton show,
right.
or you
weren't up to
it. And now there's more. It's a weirder mix of more literacy and less literacy. It's a more fractured world, and it's, and I'm not saying better or worse. It's just it's different.
Are there any magazines or websites that you have found yourself recommending to your grad students?
I tell them to look at everything.
Yeah.
So
that's kind of
continues to be fractured.
Art Forum, Phrase.
Right.
So you tell them to read Art Forum?
Oh, yeah. No, I say look at it.
Yeah, that's,
God's sake,
that's
don't
a good
read
point. Thank you for clarifying. Yeah.
Yeah. See who's showing where and how big the ads are.
Right.
But I think I actually think art magazines are entry level activities. And when one is starting out in the art world or as an artist, you gotta do that sort of thing.
Right.
And I remember those years with me, I would eagerly anticipate that when the magazine showed up in the mailbox, and I would eagerly thumb through it and see like who is showing where,
right,
and who's getting covered and who's covering what and what are they saying about that. And it was just really, really exciting. And then, you know, 10 years into it, I'd look over at my nightstand and like all of a sudden like, oh crap, there's 18 art forums there.
Right.
And I haven't looked at any of them. And I'm like, I'm getting lazy. And I think it changed. I did different things in the art world now and didn't need to keep up to it like that. But it was weird figuring that out, because I thought, oh, I'm not enthusiastic about art anymore. It's like, no, I'm just at a different level or different area or different
place. You don't need to depend on somebody else's stamp of approval of what's going on.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of like, as young artists, I think it's kind of your job to go see everything and figure out what your view of the world is by looking at everything. And I'm not going to tell Charles Garabedian to go see every show in LA. He's been doing it for 70 years and he knows what he's into, and his time is better spent making his stuff. And like, those are two real extremes. But I think that as one figures out what it is one's doing, one spends less time surveying the landscape. And I think the magazines are great for surveying the landscape.
I think the last question may be, unless Deb has anything.
She's going to
pick
a fight about criticality. I can tell. I'm trying to think of other words.
I told you, the knife is still in the boot. I'm just waiting.
Her next show, group show, Criticality in Seven Forms.
Do you and your fellow Times critics have a little Knights of the Round Table bar that you guys hang out at together and talk shop?
Zero.
Yeah. You guys don't even cross paths at all?
Yeah.
And that's okay?
That's the way it is.
Do you think you can talk about your own experience, but do you think the others read each other's work?
Oh, I read theirs.
Okay. Yeah.
They better fucking read me. I know some do, and I imagine everyone does. We're junkies. You know, it's...
Right, right.
There's not that much.
Yeah.
Well, it's not like I'm cranking out a novel every week. People pay attention.
What criticism will you read outside of your own paper? Will you go to the New York Times?
Oh, yeah. I still love...
The New Yorker.
I love Roberta's writing.
Yeah.
And I still get a lot out of it and really enjoy it. And I read the New Yorker regularly.
Yeah,
I guess I have one question following up on the idea of conflict and of interest, because I think...
Oh, yeah, I knew you had something
on
that.
I did.
What did we miss on that one? Because it's...
It seems to me, okay, from the outside, I think that there's a perception that critics have a particular code of ethics, but you don't know what they are. And maybe they're different for each person, or maybe they're different for a particular publication than they are.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe there's a particular code of ethics or rules for somebody working for a print paper like the LA Times or the New York Times versus somebody who's writing for a blog. But from my perspective, it feels like there is. So I guess that's kind of what I'm asking.
It is really different. Europe's really different from here, where you could, you know, it's really, really blurry. You can slide from one to the
other. In terms of roles, in terms of
collector,
what you could
critic,
be everything, and it's
I could, like say we're in Bruges, you're a dealer,
right?
I write for the Bruges newspaper. Right. You hire me to do a catalog essay, pay me handsomely, I do it. It's fine.
Right.
That would never happen in
right.
in the LA Times. So you'd say, but it's the LA Times, what the LA Times wants from me is my independent opinion.
Right.
So I cannot take money from galleries
right.
in Los Angeles. Because if I, you know, right. and if you had a show, I love the work, I wrote about it. The view, my editor's view, the newspaper's view is like, then the next show, if I reviewed it in the paper looks like they're being used as payback and they don't want that. And I think that's absolutely true. So that's like their standards are much higher in terms of conflict. And so that's where I think the conflict of interest thing is true.
That's
but it gets, it's come up in the teaching thing. Where it just doesn't hold water. It's like, you're a critic, you shouldn't be looking at artists' work. It's like, what? and then you know, and you're a curator too. And like, so? And you put your students on your show? It's like, big deal. It's but maybe it is a money thing, because most of the stuff I do is for you know, universities and you know, it's not a commercial enterprise. But in Europe, university commerce is really, really blurry.
And then the collector thing I would ask about too, because I know that when Michael was talking to Jerry Saltz, he said something about how he couldn't even accept gifts from artists. Yeah. And is that something that is
pretty true?
You can't, because then you would have an investment in their work.
Pagel bought this work from a young artist out of a show, and all of his next reviews, he's going to write about it, praising it, so the price of his collection goes up. And my, that's the perception. Like, it's, you know, I wish that this stuff I wrote about just took off in value like that. And right now, there's, you know, what I was saying, thing about not there not being these central points that hold the culture together.
Right.
There's more of a divorce between criticism and commerce than ever. Like back in the old Leo Castelli days, I think collectors wanted to know what the critics said because they were kind of betting on history.
Right.
And they wanted, you know, buy the Lichtenstein Young, and he's going to be in it for the long haul because the critics are part of it. And it was a much more kind of like a unified, organic, multi-part system. Since those, I mean, I never was alive, I was alive then, but maybe I wasn't. But I wasn't writing art criticism then. And so I didn't come into the game then. And when I came in, it was a little bit more divorced, but not nearly as divorced as it's now. Wow. Where you can have, you know, million-dollar paintings that have never been written about.
Right.
There's not, you know, it's covered in fashion magazines, and there's celebrity stories, but there's not one fart of criticism about it. And it's just like, and it's a much more kind of monstrous, speculative game where the guy's speculating, the price has to go up for it to, it's a bubble. It's going but it really is divorced from the writing. So I don't worry too much about the money side, and I deal with the meaning side. And they haven't been overlapping.
What work do you have in your collection? What art?
I don't really have most of the stuff I have is from trades with artists. So they'll, you know, artists like my New York dealers, I have a show coming up. They don't have much money for a catalog. We can pay you a little bit for your essay, but I give you a piece. So I have lots of trades and I have tons of student work.
Anything you particularly love that you want to mention?
I have a David Reed painting that I got years ago that I just still
has a place of honor in your home.
Yep. Not a place of
honor. You had to think about it.
Putting honor in my home together was the difficult thing. But it's up on the, it's on the walls. What else? That one stands out. I also got a Maxwell Hendler piece years and years and years ago that I just love. It's just a little piece of perfection.
Well, I think we've captured David's sensibility after That's all, great. Haven't we? Yeah. It only took one question. David, thank you so much
thank
for talking
you.
To us. Oh, we appreciate
my
it.
My pleasure.
Deb, that was really fun. Yeah.
That was fun. Thank you, so. Deb. Yeah. Hope I wasn't too hard on you.
That's
putting
good.
You on the spot. And?
We're out.
That was fun, wasn't it? We had fun. I had fun even editing it, so I imagine you had fun listening to it. Do let us know what you think. And thank you again very much to David Pagel for being such a good sport and fun to talk to. I don't know if you would have expected that from a critic, from a major newspaper art critic, but there you go. Expectations overturned. The website, again, is theconversationpod.com, and I would very much appreciate any kind of support, and I'll tell you why. I just applied for a grant the other week. I will keep you posted on that. That would certainly be a game changer, but let's not hold our breath. In the meantime, this show is a listener-supported show, but there's no support if there is no listener support. So you can support the show financially by donating through the website. You can also support the show by going to iTunes, writing a nice review, or even quicker, you can go to iTunes, and if you haven't already, subscribe to the podcast, The Conversation, An Artist Podcast is what it's called there. And you can even unsubscribe, but once you make that first subscription, I've been told, that actually helps with analytics in iTunes, and that's a good thing. Of course, you can also follow the podcast via social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of which are linked on the website. And you can take a friend's phone, you can take a friend's iPad, you can take a friend's tablet, and you can go to Stitcher or iTunes. I'm not sure, there might be another platform as well, but you can then subscribe there for them. That's another way to do it. You can spread the word. We want this show to go big. We want this show to surpass the Christian Viveros Fauné episode. So only will we be able to do that with your forward momentum and spreading the word. I think that's about it. I thank you very much again for being here and for listening and for dropping a line and letting me know you're out there wherever you are in the world. And I will talk to you next week, next Saturday, if not the Saturday after that. If we're not weekly, we are every other week. Thank you very much again. I will talk to you soon. Ciao for now.